This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, April 8, 2004, at KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Monica Lopez, sitting in for Deepa Fernandez. We go to Abu Ghraib near Fallujah, Iraq, to evaluate the devastation of recent U.S. military attacks. D.C. editor Mitch Jezerich takes a look at U.S. policies on pharmaceutical purchases for HIV and AIDS in Africa, and the second in a special series on the drug trade out of Afghanistan, an Iranian perspective. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, hundreds are protesting in Japan over the refusal of the prime minister to pull troops out of Iraq, even after the kidnapping of three Japanese citizens this week. Miles Ashdown has the story from Tokyo.
Since the end of World War II in 1945, Japanese troops have not fired a shot in action, and none have been killed in combat. But yesterday, three explosions were heard nearby a Japanese camp in Iraq, and Al Jazeera showed video of three kidnapped Japanese civilians that terrorists say they will kill unless Japan removes its 1,100 self-defense forces from the country. An Arabic statement from the captors said Japan had betrayed Iraqis by supporting the U.S. occupation. The Japanese troops are working only on reconstruction efforts in Iraq, like providing water for the local population. Peace activists in Japan have called the U.S. urged deployment a violation of Japan's pacifist constitution. In Tokyo, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miles Ashdown.
13 U.S. senators asked Pentagon officials for details on private contractors working in Iraq. David Enders has more from D.C.
Concerns expressed in the letter include, quote, the question of the adequacy of United States troop levels in Iraq. Security in hostile fire areas is a classic military mission. Delegating this mission to private contractors raises serious questions. The letter also asks that the Pentagon provide information about how many private security personnel are employed by the Pentagon in Iraq, as well as lay down rules of engagement for such contractors. After four men working for a North Carolina-based security firm were killed in Fallujah last week, attention has been drawn to the more than 10,000 foreign security personnel operating in Iraq. A Pentagon spokesman said a reply to the letter would be made in a timely manner. I'm David Enders, reporting from Washington for Free Speech Radio News.
Tamil Tigers are insisting that the government of Sri Lanka take a more serious look at their proposal for self-rule. Today, violence broke out between two factions of the Tamil Tigers, further threatening the dragging peace process. Honiya Manikavasagam reports from Vunia.
Sri Lankan Tamil Tiger rebel factions exchanged fire for the first time since the movement split early last month, killing at least 8 on both sides and another 8 were wounded, according to military and Tiger officials. Vinayagamurthy Muralidharan, best known as Colonel Karna, the eastern commander of the Liberation Tigers, accused his leadership was mistreating the Tamils in the east and broke away from the main group with about 6,000 of the rebels' 15,000 fighters. Although the fighting takes place in the rebels' territory, the Scandinavian Truth Monitor said it is a violation of ceasefire, as several hundreds of civilians in the area have sought refuge in temples and schools. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam from Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
Gulf War I POWs have been denied access to frozen Iraqi assets because the U.S. Justice Department says President Bush took Iraq off the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Celie Jenkins has more from D.C.
A $653 million judgment that was intended as compensation for U.S. soldiers who were captured and tortured during the first Gulf War has been overturned. The U.S. Justice Department successfully argued that since President Bush removed Iraq from the list of terrorism-sponsoring states last year, these men are no longer eligible to receive their money. The president signed the order so the frozen assets could be used instead for reconstructing Iraq. But for now, the soldiers who have been waiting since 1991 for their money are angry with the U.S. government, who promised to compensate them for their efforts. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Celie Jenkins.
About half of all adult Americans lack the health literacy they need to properly care for themselves and their families. Kelly Ramirez has the story.
According to an Institute of Medicine report called Health Literacy, A Prescription to End Confusion, about 90 million American adults have difficulty understanding dosages, taking prescriptions, reading food labels, and filling out informed consent forms. low reading skills, or an inability to process numbers are not the only problems. Complex medical terminology, or the patient's emotional state when medical instructions are given, can contribute to health illiteracy even among well-educated people. Dr. Harvey V. Feinberg, president of the Institute of Medicine, says that the health illiterate are less likely to seek preventive care, less likely to understand the full effects of AIDS, asthma, and smoking, and are more likely to use expensive emergency services. Feinberg thinks that healthcare providers can help by drawing diagrams, using simpler words, talking a little slower, or asking patients to repeat the information they were given. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
One year ago, U.S. troops toppled central Baghdad's statue of Saddam Hussein. It symbolized the end of his regime and victory for U.S. military forces. A year later, the U.S. occupation of Iraq continues. The latest Pentagon figures report 455 U.S. troops killed in Iraq since the start of the war, 49 in the past week. Sunni and Shiite rebels battle against American military attacks, resulting in devastation for civilians in Fallujah. U.S. forces called a ceasefire at midday to allow delegation into the area and to allow residents to bury their dead in a local football stadium. However, as FSRN's Baghdad correspondent Aaron Glantz reports, helicopter attacks have begun once again.
In Abu Ghraib near Fallujah, Sheikh Harid Adari's mosque is overflowing. He reads a fatwa, a religious edict forbidding Iraqis from helping foreigners of any type, especially Americans. The edict forbids the purchasing of any American or British products.
In these days, there will be a victory for Fallujah, for all of Iraq, and for the entire Arab nation. This is a battle of history, the battle for all of Iraq. The Mujahideen who are fighting, they welcome death. They want to be martyred.
Sheikh Adari also asks his congregation to donate medicine and for kerosene and gasoline to power the local hospital, which has been overrun with thousands of wounded. Hundreds of Fallujah's residents are dead. Businessman Hamza Al-Hamza comes from a prominent Fallujah family. He says two of his cousins were killed and five injured when an American warplane bombed their house.
And Mr. Bremer gave them order, if you will stay in your house, you will be safety. They are stay and do not carry any things, no weapon, no include with the Mujahideen, and they are stay. They are civil family. And the bomb over their house, everybody two killed, five injured.
U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer announced a ceasefire in Fallujah this morning, saying humanitarian aid would be allowed in and civilians would be allowed to leave. Negotiations were to take place between respected clerics and U.S. Marines, but at airtime, American helicopters continued to attack Fallujah. Hamza Al-Hamza says after 2 days, his family members still lie in the living room, dead.
2 days. Put ice from the refrigerant over them. 2 days. Spent 2 days, and he will look for in the garden. Maybe he will put them in the garden now, because they don't have a place. If you are going outside, maybe he will kill everybody. Going outside of his house, the military of the army of America, maybe they kill him. You know, you are leave with the two guides was killed. What can you doing to them?
The American invasion of Fallujah is almost universally reviled by the Iraqi people. Even Adnan Bachchi, a millionaire businessman appointed by the Bush administration to the Iraqi Governing Council, has called the siege of Fallujah unacceptable and illegal. Another member of the Governing Council, Mohsen Abdul Hamid, whose offer to mediate the dispute was rejected by the American government, told the Arab satellite channel Al Jazeera he would resign from the council if the American military did not stop, quote, spilling the blood of innocent Iraqis. But there are no apologies from the Bush administration, Secretary of State Colin Powell.
Over the next days and weeks, you will see that our superb armed forces will deal with the threats they're facing now. When these insurgents have been cleared away, and then we can get back on track.
But Hamza al-Hamza says George Bush has made an enemy of every Iraqi person.
No work for everybody. No electricity. No water, clean water. Now, many people came from Fallujah. They said to me, there are many pumping from the airplane, from helicopter, from the army. Is that war with the people or with the al-Mujahideen?
Tonight, the resistance is going house to house in Baghdad, urging residents not to go outside for their own safety. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Baghdad, Iraq.
Along with international health organizations, former President Bill Clinton this week struck a deal with five pharmaceutical companies, none of them U.S.-based, to offer generically produced HIV and AIDS medication to poor countries. Abstaining from the deal is the U.S. government, as the Bush administration spends the nation's funds solely on the more expensive patented drugs. In response, African physicians and AIDS activists came to Capitol Hill to tell the administration their policy means millions of people infected with the disease will go without life-saving treatment. Mitch Jezerich files this report.
As world leaders reaffirm their commitment to never allow genocides like Rwanda to be repeated, there is another African tragedy that the world is slow to again, HIV/AIDS. That's why Dr. Lulu Oguda, who treats people with the disease in the African country of Malawi, where 15% of the population is infected, came to Washington to testify at a recent Senate committee on the crisis. She says the Bush administration's refusal to purchase cheaper generic drugs means many infected people are going without life-saving treatment.
We're having a debate about whether or not to use drugs that cost $500 a year or drugs that cost $140 a year, drugs that have been proved to be safe and effective by the WHO. It seems to me that this debate is not really about the drugs. It's not really about helping those sick Africans. No, there's something else that's underlying it. And I feel that should not really be a debate that we should be having today.
48 African countries south of the Sahara Desert make up 3/4 of the world's HIV/AIDS infected population with 30 million people. Less than 10% of them are receiving treatment. The Bush administration is rejecting the World Health Organization's standards for purchasing generic antiretroviral drugs. At a Senate subcommittee on foreign relations, Bush's global AIDS coordinator, Randall Tobias, who was the former chief executive of the pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly, explained why.
In the same way that we would not rely on and do not rely on the regulatory authorities in another country to review the dossier for a new drug application and then automatically take their evaluation and introduce that drug in the United States market, so too, I believe, do we need some stringent international standards and principles that can be used to evaluate these drugs.
Several lawmakers, including three Republican senators, have written to the president urging him to change his stand on generic drugs. Dr. Oguda hopes that the president will have a change of heart soon.
We don't have time with AIDS. This is not like, I don't know any disease that we really have a lot of time for, but this is so bad that we don't have one day to waste.
Getting quality, cheap medicines into people's bodies should be the guiding light here. And unfortunately, the Bush administration believes the guiding light should be politics and the interests of their corporate backers.
Asia Russell is with HealthGap, an AIDS activist organization to promote cheaper drugs for poorer countries.
Everyone acknowledges that the medicines we're talking about that are quality assured by the World Health Organization are safe, are effective, and are what should be the cornerstone of scaling up access to treatment. Everyone except the United States government.
As we remember the 10th year anniversary of Rwanda's genocide, which will forever leave its horrific mark when looking back on the 90s, health activists fear that the global reaction to HIV/AIDS in Africa will be the saddest mark left on the 21st century. I'm Mitch Jezerich for Free Speech Radio News.
The number of children worldwide who have lost one or both parents to AIDS is expected to reach 25 million by the end of the decade. Of the estimated 40 million people worldwide who are living with the HIV virus that causes AIDS, more than 2.5 million are underage. Meanwhile, a South African study shows that nearly one in four South African women between the ages of 20 and 24 is infected with HIV. AIDS in South Africa is overwhelmingly a heterosexual disease, and women suffer disproportionately because men tend to have many sexual partners and women are often powerless to protect themselves. In Johannesburg, Melinda Tuhus looks at some of the special challenges women face in the age of AIDS.
Dudu Dlamini is a woman living with AIDS. Her only child, Chapiso, which means promise, died of AIDS when he was two.
I went through a lot of suffering and discrimination, violent inside the house. I was married. That was my first child. Then I gave birth and a handsome son.
Dlamini was infected by her husband. After her son was born, her situation worsened, and with support from a women's shelter, she divorced her husband and joined an AIDS drug trial. She mourns that treatment came too late to save her son, but she is determined to help as many others as possible get the drugs that have changed her life. Dlamini is now the Treatment Project Coordinator with the Treatment Action Campaign, or TAC. An estimated 5 million of the country's 45 million people are HIV positive. Infection rates for females equal or outnumber males in almost every age bracket. Between the ages of 25 and 29, the prevalence of HIV among women soars to 32%, while the rate for males is 22%. The prevalence among blacks is three times higher than among South Africa's other racial groups and correlates with poverty and disruption of family life under apartheid. The ruling party, the African National Congress, took up the issue of AIDS when it came to power in 1994 and formulated a plan, but in practice, it downplayed the urgency of confronting HIV and AIDS while it addressed many other problems. The current president, Thabo Mbeki, for years questioned whether AIDS was even caused by HIV. His administration refused to provide standard treatment that would have prevented most mother-to-child transmission and improved the health of those living with the virus. Rakhari Mololani is a researcher with the Center for the Study of AIDS at the University of Pretoria. She is heading up a study of HIV risk behavior among abused women, many of whom, she says, suffer the trauma of violence and the additional trauma of HIV and AIDS.
With HIV and AIDS, you know, there is actually double violence. HIV and AIDS is, you know, it's traumatizing. Now, some of their young women on the program who are there with their mothers, they are positive as a result of being gang raped. They are positive as a result of being raped by a neighbor.
4/5 of AIDS transmissions in South Africa are heterosexual. Because of the gender power imbalance, young women are most at risk both for rape and for contracting HIV. AIDS activists have used the Right to Life clause in the new South African constitution to press their case for access to antiretroviral therapy. The Treatment Action Campaign took the health minister to court, demanding that she roll out treatment. Two of the country's nine provinces had already begun their own programs. After much delay, the national government began a small program on April 1st that will start by treating a few thousand of the sickest AIDS patients. Despite the almost overwhelming odds, AIDS activists are fired up by their successes and by the power they claim under the Constitution passed by the very ANC government that has thrown obstacles in their path. Natlatla Mbega is another TAC staffer.
I was part of those demonstrations, all these civil disobedient that we march without permission, we're able and we're allowing to be arrested. It's our right as much as a democratic country. So we've got the right to live, got the right to access to the treatment, the right to hospital. As a HIV positive person, I've got the same right as a person who's negative.
In Johannesburg, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
April 5th through 12th is National Public Health Week, with public health fairs, seminars, and more throughout the United States. Organizers of the event are focusing this year on eliminating health disparities among subsections of the U.S. population. As Darby Hickey of the D.C. Radio Co-op reports, community members support the theme of moving from statistics to solutions, but are critical of failures to consider the social context of health.
Experts and community advocates around the country are working together this week to tackle the issues of health and healthcare disparities. People from traditionally marginalized communities represent disproportionately high numbers of negative health statistics. For example, studies show that 70% of new HIV infections are among blacks and Latinos, who make up less than a quarter of the general population. Health disparities are created by the context of history and power relations of different races and ethnicities, says Michael Byrd, executive director of the National Native American AIDS Prevention Center.
I think personal responsibility can be a way of scapegoating people and just putting it all on them. And I think that people need to exercise personal responsibility, but people also need to recognize from a contextual perspective my sort of commentary on health disparities for American Indian populations was, well, just give us our land back, and then we'll deal with our own health disparities, because then we'd have the land, the resources. The fact that Indian people were dispossessed of their land and their resources put them at a disadvantage that they continue to have to try and overcome.
Michael Byrd spoke recently at a crowded town hall-style meeting in D.C. on racial and ethnic health disparities. The U.S. Surgeon General, Richard Carmona, also spoke. The key to closing the gap is prevention, which Carmona says requires individuals to make different decisions to improve their health.
The prevention agenda is extremely important as it relates to health disparities. And as I draw my own experience, every day, 2-3 out of every of the 4 patients that I admitted didn't have to be in front of me. There were people that were involved in violence, there were gunshot wounds, there were drug problems, people who made bad decisions that day. And then we had people that made bad decisions across their whole life.
President Bush is dedicated to increasing funds for research and action on health disparities, according to Surgeon General Carmona. That money won't reach some communities that need it most, says Cheryl Pearson Fields. She is a research director at the Montner Project, an organization which addresses the health needs of lesbians and other women. Pearson Fields says the National Public Health Week theme of moving from statistics to solutions doesn't adequately address lesbian, transgender, bisexual, and gay people, who the National Institutes of Health continue to exclude from research on health disparities.
I think anytime you begin to have a public discourse about disparities in healthcare, that is a worthwhile endeavor, because there's a lack of real recognition, particularly when you look at the report that came out of the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research and how it was initially kind of watered down and issues of race and ethnicity were sort of extracted from the report and then put back in the report. And so I think anytime we engage in these conversations and begin to talk about rural health care, economically disadvantaged, environmental issues, as well as ethnic and cultural issues, that's important. The exclusion of LGBT issues from that discussion is troublesome.
During the recent public comment period for the Institute's strategic plan, comments focused on the need to also include prisoners and underrepresented ethnic and racial groups such as Haitians, Samoans, and Hmong. There is hope for the future in focusing on community-based efforts and looking at the larger picture, including the lack of a national healthcare system, says Georges Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association.
We have to rebuild the nation's public health infrastructures. APHA has 3 top priorities. One is getting universal access to healthcare, 2, eliminating disparities, and 3, rebuilding a public health infrastructure in no priority order. We're going to make sure all 3 of those things happen as quickly as we possibly can.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey.
In the second part of her report on the opium trade, Fariba Nawa crosses the Iranian border to western Afghanistan in a town where drug traffickers, addicts, and opium farmers lead a volatile life under the rule of a weak and corrupt local government. Afghanistan supplies 75% of the world's heroin. Fariba Nawa visited the region and brings us this final report.
Dozens of 4x4 trucks speed on the dusty roads of Uriyan and disappear into the lawless hills heading to Iran. They are filled with a cocktail of narcotics, mostly fresh opium harvested from the fields in the southern part of the country. Turbaned men sit in the back of the trucks armed with rocket launchers and other sophisticated weaponry, ready to shoot. This is the Silk Route to Death. The head of Uriyan Hospital, Dr. Gol Ahmad Danish, has witnessed the district's demise.
The economic staples of agriculture, sheep herding, and smuggling produced little profit. Taliban encouraged an open-door policy of selling narcotics, and now we have 3,000 addicts in a desperate situation.
Uriyan is a district of 180,000 sheep herders and nomads in the province of Herat, which was on the trail of the Silk Route centuries ago. Now it has become one of the major drug smuggling routes because it is only 2 hours from the Iranian border. The opium travels from Iran to Turkey and the Gulf countries, where it is refined into heroin. The value multiplies once it reaches the streets of London and New York, but here at the source, the risks are higher than the benefits. Hundreds of women are widowed because their husbands carry drugs to the border and die in shootouts with other traffickers, or the Iranian government kills them. Iran advertises zero tolerance for drug smuggling, and those caught are often executed in prisons or on the border. It is the Afghan women who end up owing money to drug lords for the opium their husbands could not deliver. Shafiqa Akhtari married when she was 14 years old. She has two children and supports herself by weaving carpets.
My husband disappeared 4 years ago after he took the drugs. There were six of them. Only two came back. He was a courier, not the dealer. He got caught in a shootout with the Iranians, and we don't know what happened after that.
Some families sell their daughters to drug lords to pay off opium debts. Many of these girls light themselves on fire and commit suicide. Herat has the highest suicide rate for women in the country. The local government denies involvement in the trade, but opium farmers say a six-member commission collects 4 pounds of opium for every acre as tax, similar to the Taliban. Yet on some days, the government burns drugs they claim to have seized in front of the Ghorian fort to show that they are fighting the drug trade. The chief of crimes, Khaja Nik Muhammad.
We aim to stop the cultivation because it is responsible for our demise, our misfortune, and indignity. Unfortunately, we don't have enough tools and resources to get rid of these properly.
The American and British governments are worried that the opium trade is funding their enemies, but they are in a quagmire because the warlords that the U.S. financed to fight the war against the Taliban are actually the main benefactors of opium money. Eradication efforts have had minimal success. Kemal Kurspahik, spokesman for the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime.
That was actually a combined effort which was also based on expectation, on the hope that there will be alternative development throughout Afghanistan that will compensate for the loss of income for poor farmers that in years of lawlessness in the country have resorted to growing opium. What we had is still a huge amount of opium produced because there was no alternative and there is no security.
Returning refugees from border countries like Iran and Pakistan come home addicted to drugs and jobless. Beggars, who are also addicts, line the streets in Ghorian. The governor of Herat opened a treatment clinic, a novel idea in Afghanistan. Muhammad Shah is a 39-year-old addict from Ghorian inside the clinic.
I've been addicted to heroin for 12 years. I came here voluntarily 2 months ago to quit. I went to Iran and first I started smuggling, and then I became addicted. I have six sons and two daughters. My family hated me until I decided to quit.
But few actually give up their habit after treatment. Ghorian's educated class has formed a council to address some of the problems in the district, but standing up to drug mafias and corrupt governments is beyond their means. For now, the only means of survival is to deal narcotics, and Ghorian is only one town on the frontier of this landlocked country where borders are open doors to the lucrative and deadly global drug trade. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Fariba Nawah.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Monica Lopez.